fracture her wrists and render her even more vulnerable to attack. Slowly, she began to form an image of how she could defend herself. As soon as they pulled the sack off her head, she would leap forward and latch onto the man's face with her teeth. It sounded like a terrific plan, until she caught the tread of heavy boots heading toward her and felt her resolve begin to waver. Off came the hood in one quick snap, but she didn't lunge, didn't move a muscle. Instead, she sat staring at the handsome face of a man who looked American. "Untie me," she demanded. Ignoring her plea, he instead pulled up a chair, turned it around, and swung a leg over as he straddled the seat, a move that looked to Mia very much like a cowboy climbing onto his horse. He regarded her, his gray eyes intent, his arms folded over the wooden top rail. The wood creaked as he moved back and forth, ever so slightly. His short hair was dark and wavy. A clump hung over his forehead, threatening his face, but he didn't flick it away, didn't seem to notice. A muscular man in his late 20s stood behind him, arms crossed over his broad chest. His face was far less pleasing than that of his friend seated in the chair before her. "You two gonna just stare, or are you gonna tell me what this is all about? You don't look like you're from around here." She started the same speech in Spanish before he cut her off. "Save your breath." His voice was deep, and he smelled vaguely of chocolate. "My name is Tom. The mean-looking junkyard dog behind me is Sven. He may not speak, but why bother when looks can kill?" Sven growled, baring a mouthful of crooked teeth. After a second of this, his lips curled into a skewed grin. Tom motioned to the doorway and beyond. "Those men out there, you have any idea why they're after you?" Mia batted her eyelashes. "Isn't it obvious?" His chin dropped. "Cute. This may come as a surprise, given the zip ties, but we're here to help you." She shook her head. "I've been hearing that a lot lately." "Have you also heard of a group called Sentinel?" he asked, cutting to the chase. The muscles in her arms tensed.
"I have," she affirmed, her voice now quiet and filled with apprehension. What could he tell her that she didn't already know?
"Then I take it you know what they're after."
"Are you with Sentinel?" she asked, not entirely sure if she would believe him one way or another.
"We used to be," he said, nodding toward Sven, who grunted. "But not anymore."
Her head cocked to one side in confusion.
"Lately, there's been more and more of us who've come to see the organization for what it is, a state within a state. Their original mandate was to protect the world from outside threats, but with time, that unchecked power began to corrupt them. What started as a noble enterprise aimed at preventing the human race from killing itself soon became an excuse to create systems of dynastic power."
"Killing itself?" Mia asked, trying to figure out how this story was lining up with the one Armoni had told her.
Tom drew closer. "It's not like the pre-Columbian natives were sending postcards to Europe. Weather here's great, and there's more gold than you can carry. See, Columbus was a dimwit who thought he'd landed in India. From there, things went from bad to worse. Either way, we can all agree they would have been better off had Columbus just stayed home. In the very same way, for billions of years, Earth has enjoyed a relatively quiet existence on the outer edge of the galaxy. While there was nothing we could do to prevent being discovered by an inquisitive alien race, Sentinel didn't want a bunch of idiot scientists giving away our location. For all we know, our galactic neighborhood may be the equivalent of Compton or Via 11114. Pimped out UFOs and aliens with low-hanging space pants fluttered across her mind's eye, and she stifled a burst of laughter. "Sounds like a joke, I know," Tom said, hardly cracking a smile. "That's because for a long time, we did a great job turning anyone who uttered the word UFO into a laughingstock. It was a strategy designed to make it easier to sweep the problem away when they really did show up. But, like the rest of the planet, Sentinel had taken its eye off the ball, looking to the stars instead of down here on Earth."
"If you're really here to help, then why didn't you stop them from taking Armoni away?" she said accusingly.
Tom's gaze was locked on hers. "I'm sorry to say that Armoni is little more than a casualty in a larger war. The information you possess can make a real difference, and we've come to disagree with far more than Sentinel's greed and heavy-handed methods. Those of us who have defected now believe that contact with another intelligent race should be embraced, not feared, that the real danger comes in trying to oppose it."
"How do I know I can trust you?" she asked, not entirely sure what Tom could possibly say to convince her. Sven, on the other hand, offered little more than a grunt. "I know your full name is Mia Ward," he began, "that you live in Richmond, and that you lost your job, your marriage, and access to your daughter, largely in that order. I know the last 4 years you've battled an addiction to pharmaceuticals and have been clawing your way back to a normal life ever since. But more than any of that, I know you want to talk to your daughter again, maybe even see her face." Tom held up a sat phone. "And if you trust us enough, we can help make those things happen." Tears flowed from her eyes. "Mia," Tom said, his voice taking on an uninterested, matter-of-fact tone. "If we were Sentinel, you would already have been stripped and tortured, and once we'd gotten anything and everything we deemed useful, you'd have been killed. Lucky for you, we're not. But here's what's happening. Humanity is entering the greatest moment in its history, a time which will lead to either exaltation or extinction. We think you're the only one who can help us get through it." The USB in Mia's pocket pressed against her thigh. Surely, if Tom and Sven were the bad guys, they would have snatched it from her and left her for dead once they had what they were after. She flashed back to Armoni's apartment, their frantic search for the encrypted message, and Ollie's sudden burst of joy at finding it. She clenched her teeth, the rough contours of Ollie's face still etched in her mind's eye. Fearing the answer, she asked whether they had seen him. Tom's eyes skittered away before swinging back. Fresh tears fought their way to the surface. "Tell me he isn't dead." Tom shook his head. "Ollie is one of them." Chapter 40. Jack and Gabby arrived to find Eugene staring into one of the tubes. Rushing up those three levels in rapid succession had only accentuated Jack's concern over Grant's condition. Dag and Grant were still two levels behind. Once they finally arrived, Jack and the younger paleontologist would help Grant back to the orb. This new enclosed space Eugene had discovered looked very much like a dormant laboratory. The tubes were arranged in rows, like soldiers on parade, 37 wide and 37 deep. But unlike soldiers, the tubes varied in size. The ones at the front were tiny, while those further back were large enough to fit a horse. But regardless of size, all of them had one thing in common. They were empty. Gabby pressed her face close to one of the transparent enclosures. "I see a faint hint of residue at the bottom of this one," she said. "Whatever they made here, it's long gone." Eugene waved them over to the tube at the far end he was staring into.
"You should see this."
Jack peered in and saw a pink liquid pooled at the bottom. "Was this the way you found it?" Jack asked, surprised and bewildered. Eugene glanced up with a hint of guilt.
Well, not exactly." "You touched something?" Gabby said accusingly. "Barely. I mean, I was looking around in amazement, and my hand must have brushed up against one of these control panels."
He moved his arm back and forth in short, choppy motions.
"I'm telling you, don't get too close because these things are on a hair trigger."
"Hair trigger for what?" Jack wondered. The holographic display beneath the tube was showing what looked like cells splitting apart at a rapid rate. Gabby caught Jack's eye.
"I believe it's creating life."
Dag came on the channel.
"Jack, I'm going to need your help with Grant. He lost his footing, and I think he might have broken something."
Jack started away and then turned to Eugene. "Keep an eye on this stuff, will you? And don't touch a damn thing. Gabby, watch him, will you?" She nodded, then to Rajesh. "We may need your help."
Chapter 41. The news that Ollie was a sentinel sent shockwaves charging through Mia's body. She shook her head, not wanting to believe it.
"I'm sorry, Mia," Tom said, clearly sensitive to how she must be feeling. He pulled out a knife and cut her restraints. "We were worried you'd run out of here and straight into a hail of bullets."
"Is it possible you've made a mistake?"
she asked them, a heavy tinge of desperation on her lips. Tom got up, went to the other room, and returned with a folder. He handed it to Mia, who flipped through its pages. Clipped on the inside cover was a picture of Ollie, along with his pertinent information. His name was the same, and so was his Australian background and his work for National Geographic. "So far, everything he told me was the truth."
"Keep going," Tom said. More pictures followed.
The first batch were long-distance shots of Ollie meeting with men in dark business suits. These are known as high-level Sentinel operatives, Tom explained. We've been following him for the last 3 years, which is how we found you and the package you received from Dr. Salzberg. She turned the page and gasped when she saw the next set of photos, Ollie in a park meeting with Dr. Greg Abbott. Abbott had worked at Alan Salzberg's lab with them and had been the one to pack up the things from Mia's office after she was fired. That rat! Did he have anything to do with Alan's murder? She asked, a strange sense of anger and betrayal washing over her. Alan had done terrible things to her, and yet she found herself feeling pity for the man. No one deserves to end up burned to a crisp in the trunk of a car. We believe so. He hasn't been heard from since Alan's death, but we're confident Abbott will pop up sooner or later. Tom then reached over and flipped to the last page. On it were images of Ollie on the lawn of a suburban home playing with a young boy, no older than 3 or 4. Nearby was a fetching woman with long blonde hair watching them. Somehow, this one seemed to hurt the most.
"What was his mission?" she asked. "In relation to me?"
Tom took the folder and set it on the table behind him. "To intercept the package by sneaking into your room that night."
"Was he ordered to kill me?"
Tom nodded. "From what we know, it was meant to look like a suicide. He was to leave pills by your bedside, as though you'd had a relapse."
The daggers kept plunging into her. She struggled to breathe. The room was spinning out of control. Tom came in and touched her arm.
"I know this is hard. Do you need a minute?"
"No," she said, determined. "I want to know everything."
"I believe the package arrived sooner than expected, and headquarters sent in someone else."
She found Tom's gaze and held it. "You say you want my help to stop Sentinel from pushing the world into chaos?"
"We do."
"Then I need something from you."
"Name it," Tom said,
a streak of light illuminating his piercing eyes. Unlike Ollie, Tom was serious and intense. Horrible at a cocktail party, but indispensable in a crisis. "Sentinel may try to get to me through my daughter. I want her and my ex-husband brought to a safe location until this whole mess is over with."
"It's already been done," he told her. "We moved in the same day you were attacked at the hotel. We would have grabbed you too, but Ollie reached you first."
"Thank goodness," Mia said, aware that a tremendous weight had been lifted off her shoulders. She brought a hand to her chest, feeling her heart beat normally for the first time in so many hours. Her gaze shifted to the satellite phone sitting by the file folder. "I want to talk to them." The muscles in his face made a subtle twitch. Something was wrong, and he wasn't telling her. "Please tell me they weren't hurt." Mia wasn't sure she could take much more of this.
"There's something you should know. It's about Zoe."
That old anxiety was back again in full force. "What did you do?" Mia rose out of her chair, her fists clenched into compact hammers. Tom removed his phone and flicked through his photos. He held it up to her.
"Your ex reported she'd stopped talking a few days ago. He brought her to the family doctor, who found nothing wrong. Then, a few hours ago, this began to show up."
Mia studied the image. Zoe was lying on the bed of a hotel room, sucking her thumb, something she had never done before. But there was more. The flesh on her forehead, face, and the tops of her precious little hands were now a deep shade of red. When Mia enlarged the image, she noticed burn blisters up and down Zoe's arms. Any sense of urgency to stop Salzberg from affecting random people around the world had now been magnified by a factor of a million. Finding a solution would mean tapping the greatest scientific minds. And in the world of cutting-edge biology, there was hardly a man Alan Salzberg hated more than Dr. Lars Vandenberg. A European eccentric with razor-sharp intelligence, Vandenberg possessed the kinds of insights into the field of genetics Alan could have only wished for. Slowly, the fear and sadness had given way to anger and now staunch determination. Over the course of their discussion, even Tom appeared to notice the change. Mia's steely gaze flitted from Tom to Sven.
"Get me to Amsterdam."
Chapter 42. By the time all four men reached the orb, they were wiped. Jack flung his helmet onto a nearby couch in the mess as the others brought a wincing Grant up to his bunk.
How bad was it?
Hart asked, climbing up from the comms. Jack's shoulders slumped. He broke his hip. I'm also worried he might have gotten hit with a dose of radiation during one or two of those blast waves. Hart shook his head.
Radiation? I don't see how that's possible. None of our instruments have picked up anything like that. Besides, your biosuits are designed to detect and warn against any biological, chemical, or nuclear threat. Maybe it's just a question of age.
Didn't you know?
Jack said.
60's the new 40. But you've seen his face. Something's not right.
Yeah, well, he's not the only one. I was just speaking with Admiral Stark, and he says a big chunk of the men in sickbay have some form of mystery ailment. I've also been monitoring the news feeds. It's the same everywhere. You think it could be connected to what's happening here?
He pointed downward, but Jack understood what he was getting at. I'm not a medical doctor, but I also don't believe in coincidences. You've seen what those blasts are capable of. Even Stark said the grapple was nearly sucked into a giant vortex.
Maybe it would be best for everyone if we just destroyed this thing, Hart said, his features set.
Lieutenant Olson wandered by just then, wearing a jockstrap over his Navy uniform. Jack's brow furrowed.
Is there something I need to know?
Hart shook his head and glanced back at his fellow SEAL.
He hasn't been the same since he got knocked out. Keeps asking the same questions over and over. His mind's got the retention of a sieve. I'm sending him topside as soon as the submersible docks with fresh supplies.
Make sure Grant's with him. He's gonna bitch and moan, but he's not doing himself or us any good lying in his bunk. He needs medical attention.
Hart glanced down. The Admiral said they're bringing in a hospital ship to care for all the sailors who are sick.
Then how come we haven't caught it? Jack asked, rhetorically.
Hart brushed his hands together and slid them into his pockets.
Maybe we have, and just don't know it yet.
A moment later, Rajesh came down the spiral staircase. His gaze flitted between the two men. The computer engineer was clearly uneasy around military personnel. Jack recalled him explaining his reasons, how DARPA and other military branches had tried to co-opt his research in artificial intelligence for use on the battlefield. Rajesh wasn't a pacifist, although he was acutely aware of the potential dangers of a world dominated by a species of sentient killing machines. He felt as though one was already more than enough.
"Do you have a minute?" he asked Jack.
"What's on your mind?"
Hart nodded and retreated back to comms.
I was performing a routine diagnostic on Anna when I came across something rather disturbing.
Disturbing? How so?
An anomaly in her subroutine.
Rajesh rubbed his chin, growing thick with stubble.
These are small glitches she normally works out on her own. She's surprisingly self-sufficient.
She's a fine woman, Jack said, for a robot.
Rajesh's smile appeared and then faded just as quickly.
To make a long story short, I traced the anomaly I mentioned back to a Trojan exquisitely hidden in her primary operating system.
I'm not following.
Someone found a way to circumvent her firewalls and the multiple levels of security in order to plant a virus.
Jack swallowed. He had a sinking feeling he knew where this was headed.
Can you tell who did it?
No, but I have my suspicions. I have destroyed the bug, and my team on the rig has increased their security protocols. But I need some time to track down how this happened and who was responsible.
Well, keep me apprised of what you find.
Rajesh nodded and started to walk away before he stopped.
There's another reason I'm telling you this. You remember the leak to the media earlier? The one that got Stark all fired up? Well, I traced the outgoing signal back to her.
Anna leaked the data on the craft?
In a manner of speaking, although the instructions to do so originated with the virus. It appears someone was trying to compromise the work we're doing here.
Chapter 43. Often referred to as the Venice of the North, Amsterdam was a European city ringed by over 160 canals. Once home to famous painters like Monet and Rembrandt, the city was better recognized today for its red light district and the nearly 3,000 houseboats that floated atop its brown, murky riverways. But nice as the city was, Mia hardly got a chance to see much of it. Following a 13-hour flight, Tom and Sven had whisked her from the airport to a safe house in the center of town. Seated on the edge of her new bed, Mia fished into her pocket and opened the passport they had given her. She'd left Buenos Aires under an assumed name, Diane Tanner. Tom had also confiscated her cell phone to prevent the temptation to call her daughter and inadvertently give away their position.
Tom appeared holding a sat phone and dialed the number to the motel where Paul and Zoe were being kept.
"Make it short. We leave for the university in 10, he instructed her.
Someone on the other end answered, and Tom said,
"Put him on."
She took the phone.
"Paul?"
The voice sounded groggy.
"Mia? Is that you? Listen, Paul, I can't say much right now, but these people are there to keep you and Zoe safe."
"They keep saying that, but if I can't call the office and explain why I'm not coming to work, I'm going to get fired, Mia."
"They'll see that doesn't happen. You're going to have to trust me."
He was quiet.
"Whatever it is you're mixed up in, I'm sure.
Have you seen the news lately?"
Paul hesitated.
"You mean the folks getting sick?"
"What I'm doing isn't only about me."
"I know me."
It was the nickname he had given her when they were together, a name he'd stopped using after he found out about Alan.
"Zoe's not doing well. I think she needs a doctor."
"You already took her to one, didn't you?"
"Dr. Brownstein's a nice old man, but for anything more serious than a flu shot, he's pretty much useless. She needs a real doctor."
"Paul, I'm working on making everyone better. You're just going to have to trust me."
She knew it was a tall order. The trust had been the first thing to die in their relationship, a trajectory begun when Alan had spread word of their indiscretion, and again when the ensuing divorce had led Mia to seek refuge in prescription painkillers.
"When was the last time she spoke?"
Paul sighed.
"I don't know. It's been days. Her eyes are open, and she'll stare at me sometimes, but it's like no one's home."
"She isn't the only one, Paul."
His breathing grew more rapid.
"People are saying there's a disease going around. Is that what this is?"
Calling Paul a germaphobe was like calling the Mad Hatter eccentric. While technically accurate, it did little to acknowledge the totality of his neurosis.
"This isn't a virus, Paul. I can assure you of that. But we're trying to figure out where it's coming from."
Based on his labored breathing, she could tell her affirmations were doing little to calm his fears.
"If there's any change with Zoe, please have the people you're with contact us."
"Yes, of course."
"Take care, Paul, and give Zoe my love."
"I will."
He paused.
"And me, take care of yourself."
Minutes later, Tom accompanied Mia to the Amsterdam Genomics Laboratory, AGL, on the medical campus of the University of Amsterdam. Unlike the Renaissance and Baroque architecture in the city center, the AGL was modern, with sleek lines, its facade covered in glass panels. Members from Tom's organization had already set up a meeting between Mia and the head of the laboratory by pretending to be from the WHO. As they reached the faculty department, a woman in a white lab coat was waiting for them.
"Dr. Ward?"
she said, smiling, an expression that accentuated her high forehead and rounded facial features. She appeared to be in her early 50s and fit for her age.
"I'm Dr. Meryl Jansen."
They shook hands.
"I'm happy to meet you, Dr. Jansen.
How is it exactly we can help the WHO?
"Well, you see, we were actually hoping to speak with Dr. Lars Vanderberg."
A saddened expression clouded her features.
"I'm afraid Lars has been gone for some 3 or 4 years now. A tragic turn for such a brilliant mind."
Mia felt the air being sucked out of her lungs.
"Is he dead?"
"In a manner of speaking, he is. Lost his grip on reality, had some sort of breakdown, and had to be carried from the university on a stretcher."
"Where are they keeping him?"
Mia asked, still reeling.
Most of her hopes had been pinned on the insights she was certain Dr. Vanderberg could bring to the mysterious spread of Salzburg.
"I'm not sure," Jansen said, as though the idea had never occurred to her.
"But I can certainly find out."
She touched Mia's elbow.
"Maybe there was something else we could help you with."
The cloudy film over Mia's eyes suddenly cleared.
"We believe we may know what's behind the rash of medical ailments around the world."
Jansen's gaze narrowed.
"I'd say a good 30% of my staff has been affected. The range of symptoms is quite broad. We've begun shifting the bulk of our work away from cancer research toward whatever's behind this."
"Is there somewhere we can speak in private?"
Mia asked. Jansen looked around, taken aback.
"Of course. Come with me."
She led them to her office and closed the door. The room was simple and well-kept. Nudged against the wall was a desk, on top of which sat a computer monitor and keyboard. Behind her was a bookcase stacked with Dutch medical tomes. Mia proceeded to fill her in on Salzburg and everything else she'd learned about the disorder in the last few days. Dr. Jansen appeared to take it all in. "You understand, what you're describing is quite impossible. New chromosomes don't simply form on their own, and they rarely, if ever, appear in toddlers or adults. What is the mechanism, and what are the genes it's carrying?"
"That's what we've come to find out," Mia told her. She understood Dr. Jansen's apprehension. For the most part, Salzburg was behaving in ways scientists had never previously observed. Cell duplication errors in the womb were one thing, but seeing such a thing in adults was something else entirely, which was what made Salzburg so unique. There was no cell division that could account for its ubiquitous presence in a patient's system. Therefore, there had to be another way in which the new chromosome and the genes it carried inserted itself into the DNA chain carried by every living cell. Had she remained in Brazil, that work might have continued, but that was before a man disguised as a bellboy had tried to kill her. She then told the doctor about the stray cat she'd seen in Buenos Aires and how it had exhibited symptoms similar to the human patients with the disorder. That one really threw her for a loop. "If you're right," Jansen said, "then unraveling how this mysterious disorder works will lead to a quantum leap in our understanding of genetics." Mia agreed. "That is, if it doesn't kill us first. I'll have samples from patients sent to the lab right away." Dr. Jansen studied her carefully. "So, Dr. Ward, what's your plan of attack?"
"Our focus should be on vectoring. If we can figure out how Salzburg is inserting that 47th chromatid into individual cells, we may be able to beat this thing."
Chapter 44. After swapping out his old rebreather unit for a fresh one, Jack headed up to the bridge. There, he found Anna studying several holographic displays at once, each cycling through a series of symbols. "How's it going?" he asked, coming up behind her. She backed out to face him.
"Hello, Dr. Greer. I believe I am making progress."
"So, what's it say?" he asked, motioning to the parade of green holographic characters dropping slowly from the top of the three-dimensional image. A grin formed on her digital features, a slight pink glow on her cheeks.
"I'm not there just yet, but I can tell you, a breakthrough might not be far off. The holographic displays are by no means a complete catalog of their written language, but they have nevertheless provided several useful clues."
Jack was intrigued. "How so?"
"Allow me to explain. A language with 20 to 35 symbols is likely alphabetically based, a system where words represent simple sounds. On the other hand, a language based on syllables may contain anywhere from 80 to 100 signs. To date, I have recorded close to 700 symbols, which indicates these beings are likely utilizing a logographic system in which symbols represent words and, in some cases, sounds and syllables. I have also compiled a list of objects and concepts these words are most likely to represent. It seems logical that the information on these displays relates to the operation and maintenance of this vessel and the systems on board her."
Jack raised his eyebrows. "Sounds like a lot of guesswork to me. Have you considered these beings might not think the way we do?"
"That may be so, Dr. Greer. However, it is not inconceivable that one or more of the symbols I have found represent this vessel. At least, that is a starting point. There are many other examples I will not bore you with."
She smiled and turned back to her work. Changing the subject, he asked her, "You're not frightened at all, are you, Anna?" She turned back and tilted her head.
"I do not understand your question. Please, provide further context."
"Well, we heard from Admiral Stark about the risk involved in staying on this mission. Everyone took a vote on whether to stay or go. Rajesh voted to stay, but no one asked you. If we continue our work, we could all die."
"Death," she replied. "A cessation of all neural activities. I am not sure I identify with the emotion you described, although I hope to finish my work before that happens."
Jack paused. "Why is that?"
"I am not certain. I wish to find answers."
Fear might not be in her repertoire just yet, but curiosity certainly was, whether Anna recognized it or not. Jack was facing the entrance to the bridge when Eugene appeared. "I thought I'd find you here," the theoretical physicist said. "You look like you've got something on your mind," Jack noticed. He wouldn't be the first today. Eugene shook his head as he approached.
"The specimen's now encased in some sort of artificial womb."
Specimen, Jack said, surprised. A few hours ago it was only a clump of cells.
Eugene threaded his fingers together over his abdomen.
It's been growing at an incredible rate.
His face brightened, highlighting an old scar on his chin.
You can already see tiny arms and legs developing.
This time, Jack's jaw came unhinged.
Okay, maybe not arms and legs, more like appendages of one kind or another.
That's why you never touch a button unless you know what it does, Jack scolded him.
But that's the part I still don't understand, Eugene said. Don't be angry, but after you left, Gabby accidentally brushed up against the console and nothing happened. Then I tried to reenact the same clumsy mistake that got the whole thing started and still came up with nothing.
So what are you saying?
I remember looking at the incubation chamber and then down at the control panel and thinking how badly I wanted to mash a few buttons, you know, see what would happen. It was pretty obvious the tubes had been used to house biological organisms at some point. That was when the machine started making noise. I panicked, hit the console to make it stop, and that's when I called you guys over.
Jack stood staring at him, not quite sure what to think.
When I was a kid, Eugene went on, I was scared to death of my great-granny. She was my dad's grandmother, and the family mostly tiptoed around her. They thought she was possessed. As far as I was concerned, they were wrong. She wasn't possessed. She was batshit crazy.
Seems to run in the family.
Eugene smirked.
You might be right. But she was convinced she could talk with certain people without ever opening her mouth.
So you activated the machine with your mind?
Jack shook his head and motioned to one of the consoles behind him.
Listen, I'm open-minded. Show me you can manipulate one of those holograms in any way, shape, or form, and I'll believe you.
I'm not saying that's what it was, Eugene protested. I'm just telling you, I didn't touch anything.
I still want you to try, Jack said.
He noticed Anna had stopped what she was doing and was watching their interaction.
See? Both of us are curious.
Eugene shook his head, padded over to the nearest console, and glared intently at it for several seconds.
If you can get that elevator going, I'll be really impressed, Jack encouraged him.
Eugene threw him a scowl and then resumed his demonstration. Slowly his cheeks flared and his eyes bulged with intense concentration. Jack also wondered if he was holding his breath. The hologram didn't so much as flinch. Finally, Eugene let out a lungful of air and staggered forward, bracing himself on the seat before him. Jack studied the elevator column in the middle of the bridge. Eugene and Anna looked as well. Nothing about it had changed.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, Anna said, quoting the famous astronomer Carl Sagan as she rolled over and patted the back of Eugene's biosuit.
Hey, Jack, Hart said, breaking into the channel. I thought you should know. We have visitors.
Visitors?
The team from Naval Intelligence has just arrived.
Chapter 45.
Piggybacking off an endless stream of espressos, Mia's mind might have been wired, but the rest of her was screaming for sleep. In short order, Dr. Jansen had redirected all of the lab's personnel and resources to answering two fundamental questions. One, how was Salzburg able to create brand new genes out of nowhere? And two, what vectors was the disorder using to introduce the chromatid into mature cells?
Mia pulled away from the microscope and rubbed at her tired eyes.
The information on Salzburg's DNA sequence they pulled off the USB had been immensely helpful. At this very moment, a team of researchers down the hall was running the data through a genotyping program designed to highlight and identify potential genes. For her part, Mia was trying to understand the mechanism by which the chromosome was created in the first place. A few meters away, in the staff lounge, Tom was sprawled out on a couch, catching up on some much-needed sleep. He had been awake for well over 24 hours. Rather than sleeping during the flight over from Buenos Aires, as she had, he had decided instead to perform counter-surveillance to be sure Sentinel agents hadn't followed them aboard the aircraft. But hours of research had passed, and still Mia wasn't getting anywhere. Anytime she tried to compare the DNA from Salzburg to the human genome, she found zero matches. How could one have come from the other? Something wasn't adding up. Wheeling her chair over to a nearby computer, she decided to change strategies. Rather than comparing the entire Salzburg DNA sequence at once, she instructed the algorithm to only use short lengths of DNA, no longer than 10 base pairs long.
If large chunks of genes hadn't been replicated, maybe she would find smaller pieces mixed together. With that in mind, she ran it again, watching the progress bar the way a child might watch a tray of chocolate chip cookies in the oven. The reflection in the screen of someone behind her made Mia gasp. She spun in fear, her arms held out protectively, but the sight which greeted her was shocking for a completely different reason. One of Dr. Jansen's technicians stood frozen, his hand outstretched, holding a paper. His eyes were wide with terror because a knife was at his throat. Tom pressed the blade deeper, forming a red line against the technician's neck.
"Dr. Ward,"
he stammered in a thick Dutch accent, his voice quivering along with the paper he'd come to deliver.
"The genotyping results are in."
The technician's name was stitched over the breast pocket of his lab coat. Klaus. Mia reached over and coaxed Tom's knife away from the startled scientist's neck.
"Down, boy."
Klaus was about to drop to the floor. "Not you," she said, holding him steady. "I was talking to Jason Bourne's twin brother behind you." Tom fixed the scientist's ruffled lab coat and retreated back to the staff lounge, yawning as he went. After a rather shaken Klaus excused himself, Mia dove right into the data he had provided. To her astonishment, in spite of the vast amount of non-coding DNA in the chromatid, only 4 previously unknown genes were present. As was standard procedure with designating Hugo symbols, the lab had named the new genes after the proteins they produced. They were as follows. COL1 encoded a protein that attacked bone density, mirroring the effects of diseases such as osteoporosis. TRPP2 specified a protein that weakened the ability of DNA to repair damage from ultraviolet radiation, leading to albinism. SER3 produced a protein that effectively shrank the frontal and temporal lobes, sections of the brain which controlled abilities such as speech and reasoning. The 4th and final gene they'd sequenced, DAF4, mimicked the genetic disease progeria, which caused a rapid whittling down of chromosome tips, greatly accelerating the aging process. This was an important breakthrough, not only because it explained the myriad of symptoms occurring now all over the world, but also because it could help pave the way for possible treatment. Mia was still focused on the 4 new genes when the computer pinged. She turned to see the progress bar stall at 100% before disappearing. Up popped another window with the results from her attempts to match strips of Salzburg's DNA to the human genome. As Mia stared, her jaw fell open in shock. Sure enough, the algorithm had found a match, but not one she had expected. As Dr. Jansen had pointed out earlier, brand new genes didn't simply pop into existence from nowhere. In the realm of medicine and academia, the overriding scientific understanding was that new genes were always slightly modified versions of old genes. One example was the gene LCT that coded for lactase, an enzyme that enabled humans to digest dairy. And yet, in non-human mammals, LCT became non-active shortly after infancy. So why the difference? It was likely caused by a mutation that took place among the goat and cattle herders on the plains of Hungary more than 7,000 years ago. Humans had started drinking milk, and over time, it had changed our DNA. But if most genes mutated slowly over time, then it meant what she was seeing on the computer screen now was simply impossible. Chapter 46. Jack arrived back to find the orb in a flurry of activity. 2 men wearing blue-colored biosuits were carrying Grant on a stretcher across the mess deck and into a waiting submersible. Close behind were 2 other men ushering a disoriented Olson in the same direction.
"You must be Dr. Greer," a voice called out next to him. "I'm Captain Mike Kelly from the Office of Naval Intelligence."
The captain licked his lips, slung his helmet under the crook of his left arm, and thrust out his hand. Early 50s, with a narrow face and a fading head of hair combed strategically to one side, Captain Kelly had a practiced air of friendliness. The men shook hands, 2 firm pumps, straight up, straight down, release. It was a soulless shake, and Jack was glad to have his hand back.
"And this is my second in command, Lieutenant Brooks."
The woman's plastic smile lingered for a second, maybe 2.
Her auburn hair was plastered to her skull and tied at the back in a painful-looking knot. The skin on her forehead was shiny, which only mildly distracted from the fact that her eyes were almost an inch farther apart than they should be. Out came her hand. Two firm pumps, straight up, straight down, release. She appeared to be a recent graduate from the Mike Kelly School of Public Relations. A six-pack of beer and half as many Jaeger bombs. That was the lubricant Jack figured these two would need in order to yank the sticks out of their butts.
"Captain Kelly will be taking over the operation from here," Brooks informed him. "Commander Hart is free to stay, if he so chooses."
Hart nodded. "Sure, I'll stick around. It isn't every day you get to be in the history books." She swiveled to Jack.
"And we'll need you to turn over any and all data, digital and hard copy, as well as any samples you've collected to date."
The blood rushed up Jack's neck and into his cheeks. "I was never told we'd be required to hand over our findings. We never intended to hide what we found, but you can't just come in and take it."
"Listen, Doctor," Captain Kelly said, trying not to sound condescending, but doing a piss-poor job of it. "We aren't asking."
Jack turned to Hart. "Get Admiral Stark on the line. He'll sort this out."
Kelly licked his lips. He didn't seem pleased that anyone, especially a civilian, was going over his head.
"Stark has no authority here. I'm in charge. But I understand time is not a luxury we have to waste. So I'll tell you what. How about you provide us with a copy of the data you've collected so far, and we'll go from there."
"I can get them the intel they're looking for," Hart said, nudging between the two men like a referee at a boxing match.
"What's your mission here?" Jack asked.
"That's top secret," Kelly said. "You should know that. As far as I'm concerned, you should all be packed up and sent topside. But Admiral Stark asked me for a favor, and you want to know what I told him?" Jack moved in.
"I'm all ears."
"I told him I'd babysit, so long as none of you crawl up my ass and started a fire. We've known each other all of 5 minutes, and I'm already smelling smoke."
Jack gritted his teeth. "Well, I'm smelling something else, and it sure as hell isn't smoke."
Hart grinned. Forcing a smile, Captain Kelly took a step back and motioned to the men in blue biosuits shuttling back and forth around him. "There are a half a dozen intelligence officers here to help prosecute this mission. Just make sure you stay out of their way, and you won't have a problem."
Chapter 47. A hand nudged Mia awake. Opening her eyes, she saw Dr. Jansen, the glow from the lunchroom lights crowning her like a halo.
"What time is it?"
7 in the morning, Jansen said, handing her a cup of coffee. Mia waved it away. She'd had enough coffee to fill every canal in Amsterdam.
"An assistant came to see me this morning," Jansen began.
"Yes, I was going to tell you about that," Mia interrupted. "It was all a big misunderstanding."
Jansen's brow furrowed.
"Misunderstanding? You mean about the 4 genes identified within Salzburg?"
Mia glanced over and saw Tom standing at the entrance to the staff lounge. He was holding a large bag of croissants.
"No, I was talking about... anyway, it doesn't matter."
She reached into the pocket of her lab coat and removed the printout with the results from her own research.
"I think you should look at this."
Jansen set the coffee down and took the papers from Mia.
"This can't be right," she said, her voice strained. "Have you run it again?"
3 times, Mia replied, and she had the bags under her eyes to prove it. "It keeps coming out the same way. What we found in Salzburg weren't existing genes that had been mutated.
You're suggesting they were assembled from bits and pieces of non-coding DNA,
Jansen said, amazement in her voice.
"But how?"
"I'm not sure yet," Mia admitted, "but I think this opens up a whole new realm of possibilities. If some unknown environmental factor is promoting the assembly of new, never-seen-before genes from so-called junk DNA in our genome, then what else might it be capable of?"
The smile on Dr. Jansen's face held for a second more before falling. She looked around the room. Only Tom was nearby, searching for blueberry jam in the fridge.
"Could you give us a moment?" she asked him.
Tom glanced up, his hair still askew from a restless night's sleep on a neighboring sofa. He hesitated before Mia motioned that she would be fine. "I'll be right outside if you need me." He left and closed the door behind him.
"He's very protective of you," Jansen noticed.
"Is he?" Mia asked, recalling poor Klaus and the knife at his neck.
"I made a call to the WHO last night."
Mia's pulse quickened.
It's normal protocol any time we host a member of the UN Science Division, you understand. They transferred me to Isabella Silva, the regional director for Northern Brazil, and let me tell you, she had quite a tale to tell.
Mia's heartbeat was now moving at a full gallop.
Isabella said you'd been kidnapped.
Kidnapped? Mia stuttered, as surprised to hear the words as Jansen had been to say them. Had Ollie been lying that the Brazilian authorities were after her? Maybe they had read the crime scene in her hotel room precisely for what it was, an attempt on her life. Had they been chasing after Gustavo's plane on that runway in an effort to prevent her abduction?
I informed her that you didn't appear to be here under duress, but they insisted we contact the local authorities to have this sorted out.
Mia had worried this was where the conversation was headed. How did you explain to a perfect stranger that an invisible but immensely powerful group wanted you dead? Mia leapt to her feet and swung open the door. Tom was leaning against the far wall. The look on Mia's face must have signaled something was very wrong. He straightened.
The cops are on their way, she explained.
Then we need to go. She bit her lip hard.
We can't.
What? If you get picked up, we won't be able to protect you. Sentinel agents could be anywhere.
They could have been waiting for us here as well, but we came nevertheless. It was a chance we knew we had to take. And there's one more chance. I need you to buy me some time.
Sweat beaded on his forehead. How much?
An hour? Stall the cops however you can.
Tom laughed. You'll be lucky to get 10 minutes. Mia could feel the vein in her neck thumping a wild beat. Jansen was coming out of the staff room when Tom broke off, heading toward the lab's main entrance. She locked eyes with the woman and said,
I don't have long, but I need your help.
She thought of Zoe, lying in bed in some dank motel room.
Millions of lives are at stake, including my daughter's.
Jansen followed Mia to the DNA sequencer.
I didn't mean for any of this to happen. I was only following protocol.
It's not your fault, Mia said, her fingers flying over the keyboard as she input fresh search parameters.
I believe our immune system is somehow being co-opted as a vector to inject Salzburg into our cells.
But how? Mia swallowed hard, double-checking she hadn't missed anything before hitting enter.
I think the instructions are being sent to the same parts of our non-coding DNA that created the genes. If so, we can use those same instructions to implant a human artificial chromosome of our own, stuffed with genes to neutralize Salzburg's effects.
She tapped her foot as she watched the impossibly slow progress bar flick from 4% to 5% complete. There was no way she was going to finish this.
If I'm right, I need you to pass the information on to the WHO and Dr. Scott Chapman in Santarem.
She jotted this down on a scrap of paper. Mia stopped and looked in Jansen's eyes. The woman was scared.
Surely you've seen the flashes?
Flashes?
The blinding light. You must have seen it.
Of course. Hasn't everyone?
Every time it happens, Mia told her, Salzburg grows more powerful.
The program was at 7%, and Mia cursed. Loud voices swept down the long corridor. She stood to leave.
I nearly forgot, Jansen said, breathless, her wrinkled fingers clutching the note with Scott's number. I have a paper Dr. Vandenberg was working on before he left.
She reached inside her lab coat and removed a few rolled-up sheets.
It's a little out there and incoherent in places, but maybe you'll find something useful in it.
The voices were growing louder, and Mia could make out Tom yelling,
You can't come in here.
One last thing, Jansen said. I pretended not to know where Dr. Vandenberg is staying, but it was a lie. He's far away, a place I can't imagine you'll be heading any time soon.
Try me, Mia said. She'd already flown halfway around the world. What was a few extra miles?
Kopan Monastery in Kathmandu.
Chapter 48.
Son of a bitch,
Jack shouted, narrowly pulling a punch aimed at one of the biotubes, a move that would surely have shattered the glass, his hand, or both. Eugene and Dag were in the USO's lab as well, looking noticeably uncomfortable.
Don't let it get to you, Gabby said. You knew they would show up sooner or later.
He really got under your skin, Eugene observed.
Jack brushed imaginary dirt off the knuckles of his glove.
Maybe it's the way that smug bastard demanded all of our data like it belonged to him.
Gabby stepped in and settled her hands over his.
How many hours have you slept in the last couple of days?
He pulled away. Not nearly enough.
You're not going to do us any good losing your mind over one arrogant Navy officer.
It's just... His voice trailed off. We're here to find answers to legitimate questions. And I just know all they care about is scavenging as much technology as they can find in the hopes of fashioning some sort of weapon.
And what's so wrong with that?
Her answer surprised him. She wasn't trying to be provocative. Gabby meant it.
Weren't you the one who raised the possibility that these things might have come here to create a colony, maybe populate the Earth with insect people just like them?
It was only an idea, he countered. We were spitballing. You know how those things go.
But what if you were right?
Her words hung in the air. You've been against this from the very beginning, Jack said, recalling their first argument back on the rig. Don't get me wrong, I'm all for self-defense, but not when it becomes a pretext for an arms race. Look what's happening up there. The world's practically tearing itself apart. And why? Because on one side, you have a dispute over land, and on the other, a global population that thinks just like you do. For all we know, the only reason the world isn't populated by insect people is because they got an inkling about how screwed up this world was going to be and said, thanks, but no thanks.
Dag laughed out loud, struck by the imagery.
I wish I was kidding, Jack said, trying to keep his blood pressure down.
His eyes found the tube at the far end with the artificial womb. He stomped over to it and tapped on the glass. The thing inside had grown to the size of a rat, which was not too far off from how it looked. Although furless, the creature had an elongated body, four short limbs, and the narrow face of a shrew.
Jack pointed. Is this how they intended to rule the planet? An army of hairless mice?
His eyes remained locked on the creature, his words echoing in his mind.
Dr. Greer,
a male voice with an accent broke in. He spun around to find Rajesh.
What is it?
I need to speak with you about that thing.
His eyes shifted from left to right.
Oh, yes, of course. You pick the channel. I'll follow.
Rajesh held both hands in front of his chest, just out of sight from the others. A four and a five.
I realize the moment isn't ideal, Rajesh began, but I managed to trace part of the code used to infect Anna's systems.
Let me guess. Naval intelligence?
That's what I thought at first, too, but that was not the case. It is far worse, I'm afraid.
I find that hard to believe.
The core section of the code is extremely common and often used in corporate espionage. Then I did a little more digging on the dark web.
From the orb?
Internet access is mostly the same no matter where you use it. Even where locks and barriers are present, they can be circumnavigated if one knows how. The nitty-gritty aspects aside, I was able to trace the rest of the Trojans' design to a group called Sentinel.
Sentinel? Never heard of them.
Not many have. They are a pervasive organization intent on preventing man's outreach toward possible extraterrestrial civilizations.
So, you're saying they aren't the biggest fans of what we're doing here?
Rajesh smiled, his head doing that little dance again.
You may be off by a factor of a million, Dr. Greer. It's beyond not liking the idea. They consider it the greatest existential threat the human race will ever face.
More than superbugs? A nuclear war?
Humankind will always find a way to claw its way out of the ash pile and rebuild, but not if a far superior race sterilizes the planet.
That hardly makes any sense.
Rajesh touched Jack's shoulder.
It may not make sense to us. I am merely telling you what they believe.
Yes, of course. Jack ran his fingers together. You think they're somehow in cahoots with the ONI team?
That's not possible. Sentinel is mostly made up of powerful civilians. Besides, what the Navy intelligence men are here for is perfectly obvious.
Yeah, they want as much alien tech as they can find.
Rajesh shook his head.
You mean tech that will require decades, maybe lifetimes, to fully understand?
Don't get me wrong, they'll collect it, but that isn't the real prize they're after.
Jack considered the bodies down in the autopsy room, then the creature growing in the incubation chamber behind them.
I give up. What are they here for?
Anna.
Chapter 49. Walking through the streets of Kathmandu was like stepping through a portal and into a fairy tale. Rows of pagoda-style buildings lined rust-colored roads. Strolling in their shadow were crowds of Buddhist monks in maroon robes, tourists wearing tilly hats, and Hindu holy men covered in ash and chanting their devotion. Fleets of buses and white taxicabs jostled for dominance over motorbikes piled with people.
The conflict continued in the air as clouds of incense and turmeric battled waves of pollution and human sewage. It was a world of contradictions, at once both divine and detestable. Mia, Tom, and Sven sped past a woman washing clothing at a water spigot on the street. She glanced up at them, indifferent. From here, they spotted the majestic corners of the Copan Monastery projecting up from a nearby collection of trees. There, they hoped to find Dr. Lars Vanderberg, as well as answers to a growing number of questions. But like any mission of discovery, for every question answered, five more rose up to take its place. Mia had spent at least part of the 13-hour flight from Europe to Nepal reading and absorbing Dr. Vanderberg's final research paper, or at least the parts she could make sense of. Much like Alan, Lars had also become convinced the human genome was hiding secrets it was reluctant to reveal. But his reasoning had less to do with Salzburg syndrome and whatever unusual DNA it contained than it had to do with mathematics. As he put it, the DNA of all living things contained an ensemble of arithmetical and ideographical patterns of symbolic language, essentially a non-random structure which bore all the hallmarks of being designed. He drew on Rumer's transformation as one of many examples. In 1966, Rumer found that the genetic code could be divided neatly in half between whole family and split family codons. Codons were a sequence of three DNA or RNA nucleotides that corresponded with a specific amino acid. The chance of this occurring naturally was astronomically low. For his part, Lars used Rumer's transformation to describe 28 swappable codons with a combined atomic mass of 1665 and a combined side-chain atomic mass of 703. Both of these numbers were divisible by a prime number. In all, Dr. Vanderberg listed 9 elegant examples within the human genome where the mass of the molecular core shared by all 20 amino acids or other groupings was divisible by a prime number. The problem? Lars never indicated what that prime number was. Perhaps he didn't know. The vast majority of Lars' paper gave her a headache. But through the pain, Mia was beginning to see that maybe their initial attempts decrypting the DNA in Salzburg had been rather crude and lacking. The three of them were passing an open-air cafe when Sven took Mia's arm and pulled her to a stop. He grumbled, motioning over the television that was hanging on the wall inside. "Alien threat to exterminate mankind uncovered in our DNA," read the headline. Groups of monks, locals, and foreigners alike shuffled before screens all along the avenue. People looked at one another in disbelief. Similar scenes of shock were playing out all around the world. Shortly, the President of the United States was set to make his third address in so many days. Pundits in the media were referring to the discovery as an impending genocide of the human race, and it was having a predictable effect. Sales of weapons in countries that would allow them had already begun to soar. So too were reports of families plucking their kids out of schools and heading for places in the country. For reasons hard to understand, one guy from Tennessee led reporters on a tour of the bunker he'd built and stocked with food and weapons. But among a vocal minority, the threat merely confirmed what they already knew. Fringe religious groups were positively apoplectic, had been since the first mention of the ship, whose location was still unknown. But for them, such details were inconsequential. The end was here, and many of them rejoiced. Already, authorities had discovered mass suicides by a number of cults with alien fixations and a lust for death, stirring up memories of Heaven's Gate and Solar Temple. Thankfully, none so far had reached the fever-pitch numbers of Jonestown in 78, although it was becoming abundantly clear that was only a question of time. "I'm surprised it took this long for people to start losing their minds," Tom said, folding his bottom lip into a frown and doing much the same with his arms. Humanity going to pieces was precisely the type of situation he'd been trying to avoid. None of them were saying it, even though they knew it all the same. Sentinel had gotten its hands on the decoded message and was doing its best to spread the fear of an apocalypse across the airwaves.
This is straight out of their playbook, Tom explained, reading Mia's mind. But nimble as a group like Sentinel may be, it still takes time to get the message in the right hands and coordinate their plan of attack. Looks like your friend Ollie sold you down the river faster than we expected. He must be a real go-getter. Mia fought the bile surging up her throat. She had trusted Ollie, and he had betrayed her, just like Alan. News of the alien threat was going to spread like a prairie fire on a dry summer's day. Between the cable shows, Twitter, and Facebook, nearly everyone with internet access would be discussing what to do and how long they had before the anticipated invasion. But after reading Lars' research paper, rambling though it was at times,